Yeah, we feature the International Affairs magazine communique from time to time here on Fresh Air. It's 10 minutes after 4 o'clock now, and joining me for a return visit to Fresh Air is writer Chaim Potok. His novels, The Chosen, The Promise, In the Beginning, and My Name is Asher Lev, have all been bestsellers. Throughout his life, he's been interested in Judaism and the culture of Jewish peoples. Chaim Potok is an ordained rabbi and the former editor of the Jewish Publication Society of America. He's now their special projects editor. His interest in Jewish history has led to his most recent book, which is called Wanderings, Chaim Potok's History of the Jews. A paperback edition of this book has just been published by Fawcett. I should also say that Chaim Potok lives in the Philadelphia area. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Why did you decide to do this nonfiction book? You're known to all of us as a novelist.
I think I needed it to focus upon the next novel that I'm writing. That is to say, the novel that I'm writing right now. I spent 16 months of my life, almost 16 months of my life in Asia, courtesy of your uncle and mine. I was in Korea, Japan, and visited the parts of China that we were able to visit at that time. Hong Kong, Kowloon, Macau. And saw a world, the barest existence of which I had known absolutely nothing about. And there was a real confrontation of cultures between my own world, my American Jewish world, and the world of Asia. Its culture, its beauties, its horrors, its paganisms. And I came back very much changed as a result of that confrontation. I've spent all of my life since that time trying to figure out who went there. And the novels were about various aspects of the individual who went there. Reuven Walter, Danny Saunders, Asher Lev, David Lurie, the boys in the novels. And this, Wanderings, is really about the culture package that they took with them there. And what I'm trying to do now is explore what happened to that culture package and the individual who went there.
What do you mean the culture package?
What 4,000-year-old civilization did I take to that place? What understanding did I have of it? At that point, of course, in my life, it was an intuitive and an inarticulate understanding. Although it was fairly clear because I had studied it for many, many years in the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, had read a great deal of my own, about Judaism. Still, the precise cultural dynamics weren't clear to me, how it was that Judaism interacted with all the civilizations with which it came into contact in its 4,000 years. So, as very often happens in the case of novelists, you experience something on an unconscious or inarticulate level, and that experience resonates inside you, and then you go back and consciously try to recreate it and give it a configuration through the faculty of the imagination, utilizing a certain aesthetic form. The novel is one of the ways that Western secular man structures his experience, the serious novel, not the entertainment novel. And he utilizes a certain aesthetic form in order to do it. And Western man does it very seriously. He structures his experience through the faculty of the imagination, utilizing a certain storytelling form. And that's the novel. And that's what I'm trying to do now with the book that I'm working on. So in a way, Wanderings was very important for me because it helped me get a clear focus on what it was that this culture package was that I brought with me. It was a whole civilization that I carried with me there, and that civilization confronted the only paganism left on the face of the planet, whatever paganism one finds in Asia. And by paganism, I simply mean nature-oriented civilizations, civilizations tied to the cycles of nature. And I, as I say, was transformed by the experience, and I'm writing about that now. We're trying to write about it now.
When you completed the research that you did for Wanderings, did you feel like any of your worldviews had been changed through the act of going back and reading a lot of history and discovering a lot of things that you probably didn't know about before?
If anything, what became changed for me was the wonder and the awe of Jewish existence. Somehow, we're talking about a people that has learned how to adapt itself to the finest in the civilizations in whose midst it finds itself, absorb, transform elements of umbrella cultures, and stop at a certain point because it feels that the essence of its own identity is being threatened, and fuse with the best in the umbrella cultures, and then give the world back this fusion. A very simple example would be the Book of Psalms. The poetic rhythms in the Book of Psalms, the parallelisms that are part of the poetry of the Book of Psalms, that is to say, the mold that we call the Book of Psalms, much of the poetry of the Book of Psalms, is pagan, is Canaanite. The ancient Israelites did not invent this kind of poetry. They took the vessel, the poetic mold, filled it with their own content. This is what I mean by fusion. They then give this fused result back to the world, and we know what effect the Book of Psalms has had upon the thinking of a whole segment of our species. A similar example would be an early medieval rabbi confronting the manuscripts of a long-dead Greek pagan, Maimonides, reading Aristotle. Two cultures crashing head-on. In this instance, it would be the cores of two cultures. That is to say, the heart of Judaism, as represented by this rabbi, is confronting the heart of Greek paganism, as represented by Aristotle. The result of that confrontation was enormous tension, because what happened was two sets of ultimate answers to what I call, for lack of any better way of expressing it, the 4 o'clock in the morning questions, you know, that we all ask ourselves sometime or another in the dead of the night when we snap awake. We are too busy during the day to ask ourselves these questions. We go shopping instead. What is it all about? Does any of this mean anything? Who am I really? What do I mean to anybody, to myself? How do I relate to this awesomeness around me? Cultures come up with answers to these questions, and when two sets of answers crash into one another, what happens is that they ask each other, why is my set better than the other? And the reason they ask each other that question is that a culture generally will go to the barricades for its set of answers. And if you find a set of answers that resonates in some way truer than yours, you wonder why you're going to the barricades for your set. That's what happens when hearts of cultures come into conflict, when two sets of world views come into conflict. So Maimonides responded to Aristotle, in some instances fused with Aristotle, in some instances rejected Aristotle and came up with a new set of answers to Aristotle. And that Maimonidean response became part of the heritage of Western civilization because much of it was used by St. Thomas Aquinas when he in turn confronted the manuscripts of Aristotle. This is what I mean by the awe and the quite spectacular dynamic of ongoing Jewish confrontation with all the umbrella civilizations that Judaism has encountered in its 4,000 years of history. Remember, Judaism is a counterculture. It's an other. It is the prime example of a small people living as an other and willing to pay the price for it. It has an alternate view of reality, and it asserts that view, but isn't blind to the answers that others give to reality, is willing to adopt for itself the best of the other answers, so long as it is not obliterated in the process.
You talk about the connections of this 4,000-year-old religion. What do you feel connects you to 4,000 years? Because hearing you talk, I get the feeling that you feel direct links to that, that you don't feel like you are outside these 4,000 years watching them as a historian could study the history of another culture.
I'm connected directly to the literature of the Bible, which for me is an extraordinary expression of 1,000 years of a people's groping with these 4 o'clock in the morning questions. It's a rich literature. It's a great literature. And I'm connected to it as a literary individual. That is to say, I look upon it not only as a theological statement about the reality of things, but as an extraordinary literary creation. It is simply one of the most magnificent bodies of literature produced by any single member of our species. Its stories, its poetry, its history, it's the first real history written by our species. Nothing known to us predates the pretty savage picture we're presented, for example, of King Saul. Kings were not weak individuals in the ancient world. No literature presents a king as a human being ruined by his own character. This was an extraordinary Israelite invention, the business of telling history as it were. At the same time, it intrigues me because I see history told through a filter, as it were. And if you understand how the filter functions, you can understand a great deal about how the human mind functions. And the filter is what scholars call the Deuteronomistic school. That is to say, a certain school of scribes developed a certain attitude toward God. And it was through this attitude that all of Jewish history is seen. And the attitude is very simple. It's covenantal. You do the will of God, you're rewarded. You don't do the will of God, you're punished. The notion of covenant, the notion of a treaty, a people making a treaty with its God, is radically Jewish. It really is an extraordinary new idea in the history of our species. A people freed from slavery, somehow it makes it, which in itself is an extraordinary event in the ancient world. Slaves didn't run away in the ancient world. They certainly didn't run away and survive. But for a whole group of people to run away, whether it was 30,000 or 300,000, whatever the number, was quite extraordinary. And in the ancient world, nothing happened unless it was caused by a god. Nothing was uncaused by a god. That's the way our species thought in the ancient world. If it was caused by a god, the question was, which god caused it? Couldn't be an Egyptian god. An Egyptian god wouldn't permit you to run away from slavery from Egypt. Couldn't be a Canaanite god. Canaanite gods are all the way up north. What do they have to do with Egypt? What god was it? That's the birth of Mosaic monotheism. The notion of a god somehow above all the other gods, and somehow controlling the destiny of man, and somehow hating slavery, and somehow ethically oriented. Then the problem becomes, how do you relate to this god? You owe that god something. He just saved you from slavery. What words do you use to express your relationship? That's the covenant at Sinai. That sense of obligation expressed in words is the treaty made between the Israelite rabble that fled from Egypt and this God whose representative was Moses, who somehow helped them get out. That's the beginning of it all. That's the triggering element in Jewish civilization. Then the invasion of Canaan, 200 years of tribal confederation, the kingdom, the breakup of the first temple, and so on. The central idea in the first part of Jewish history, the one that resonates not only for me, but for all of Western civilization, is the idea of covenant, of making a treaty, a people making a treaty with its God. That has entered Western civilization and affected the way we think the world. The second notion that's crucial that I relate to very powerfully, and that all of us relate to, whether we're aware of it or not, most of us are not aware of it. It's in the nature of a civilization, by the way, that the things that you function with on a daily basis, you're not fully conscious of. When you become too conscious of them, the civilization is beginning to fall apart. When this notion of covenant began to disintegrate, because it simply wasn't working, that is to say, the notion of you do what I want and I will reward you for it, when that no longer functioned viably, and this was during the period of Greek influence in Judea in the first, second centuries before the Common Era, the problem then became, what do we do with the covenant idea? Do we throw it out? What do you replace it with? So slowly over a period of time, they developed the notion of the reward deferred, the reward pushed into the future. That's the beginning of the messianic notion. That is the central idea of the second civilization of the Jews, that is to say, rabbinic civilization. You perform the commandments not for immediate reward, but for reward at some future time, which God will decide in His own good time. That notion took the thinking of the human species on this side of the planet and pushed it forward. And by that I mean the following. The notion of a Messiah takes the mind out of the cyclical nature orientation that is very typical to our minds, much more typical than the notion I'm about to describe to you. Summer, autumn, winter, spring. Summer, autumn, winter, spring. Summer, autumn, winter, spring. We're locked as parts of the nature cycle into this nature cycle, and we tend to think this way, or tended to think this way, until Judaism came along and wrenched us out of this spiral or cyclical kind of thinking and pushed us into a goal-oriented kind of thinking, or into what I call linear thinking. We think future words now, and we think future words precisely because of this messianic notion, which came in response to the covenantal notion that was no longer functioning. So if Western civilization is goal-oriented, which indeed it is, it's goal-oriented and future-oriented precisely because the notion of the Messiah was pumped into Western civilization by Christianity out of Judaism. The rest of the world doesn't think this way. Most of Asia, or much of Asia, doesn't think this way. Much of Asia thinks cyclically. It structures reality quite differently from the way we do.
Do either of those solutions to the questions seem better or worse?
I don't know. There's no way of making a value judgment one way or the other. I suppose 10,000 years from now, when someone looks back on the history of our species, at this point in time, we'll be able to make some sort of judgment as to which of the two ways of thinking was better. It is...
Do you think that that would ever be, that you'd be able to say that one was better?
I think with some...
Or do you think it would just be left with difference?
Both responses to your question are probably true. Some people would say that you could make a judgment if your value system was the following. If you said that the number of infant deaths was something very important in the way you measured a civilization. If you said that the number of people who weren't dying of starvation annually was the way you measured the significance of a civilization. If you said that the way one orders priorities in terms of how you plan for the future was significant in the way you value a civilization, then you would have to say that Western civilization is a more valuable civilization, let's say, than other civilizations. If you would say that what's important is less the things that I've just mentioned than equanimity of soul, tranquility, how one treats the elderly, respect for parents, family cohesiveness, father-mother relationships, father-son-daughter relationships, ancestral relationships, relationships with antiquity. If all of those are what you consider to be the significant components of a civilization, then clearly we would be found lacking in that regard. There are ways of evaluating a civilization depending upon what set of criteria you bring to bear upon them.
Hi, I'm Potok, is my guest, if you're just joining us. There's been quite a movement in the past few years towards understanding where you come from, towards understanding your own personal history, your family history, your ethnic origins, religious origins. And I wonder to what extent that becomes a romanticized notion sometimes that may be very useful but also kind of false. And what it gives to you. I'm thinking of a woman who I spoke to recently on Fresh Air from Japan. She was a novelist, and her novel was called Samurai, and it was about, she's from Japan, and it was about a Japanese family. A woman marries into the family, and there's a very tight notion of family. It's a samurai family. There's a whole code of nobility you have to measure up to. The son is sent away to America, and the family's patiently waiting for him to come back very rich because they're quite sure he will. And he's actually quite poor, ashamed to say that he's poor. He's ashamed to come back because he can't go against his family's wishes. His wife is a prisoner of the family. She can't leave, although she'd like to, because the family's insisting that she's staying. And, you know, by the time the book is over, it's an enormous family tragedy that's played out over about 50 years. She feels that a lot of the Japanese traditions had to be rebelled against, that they became very imprisoning. She's made some visits to the West Coast and in San Francisco met up with some people from the Japanese-American community, and they're beginning to discover their heritage. And she's really surprised at what's happening. People are trying to revive certain Japanese customs that she doesn't think really make sense out of their tradition, but within their tradition, she thinks they're very limiting, and she should include in that the role of women within the culture. So I don't know. It seems that your ethnic origins and your roots are both a source of history and connection, but also when you're within it, sometimes a source of something that needs to be rebelled against. And I wonder how you balance all of this in your mind, having just done your history.
I think that for a novelist, it is so absolutely crucial that one have a sense of home, a sense of a world, a real hard sense of a world that one wants to write about. Generally, the novel in Western civilization has been the instrumentality by means of which we, in the past 300 years, have focused upon precisely what you just described, individuals who have grown up inside certain closed worlds, whether they're the benign closed world of Jane Austen or some sort of hot closed world like all of Western civilization that's hypocritical enough to send tens of thousands of its young men to their deaths in the First World War, mouthing at them empty slogans like fatherland, motherland, gloriana, the kind of thing that Ernest Hemingway writes about in A Farewell to Arms. The novel is focused upon individuals in rebellion against these systems of value. Some individuals rebel against these systems of value and leave them entirely. Some leave them and return to them, leave them and return to them, and live in constant tension with them. And some say, I don't want to rebel anymore. I haven't got the strength after a while. For whatever the reason, they marry into the system of value, have children, look at the children grow up, and wonder which of the three steps the children are going to take when they make their first solo steps into the real world. This is the ongoing reality, I think, of our species. It is part of the fabric of the world in which we live that it consists of the following structure, I think. It's built into this stage of history on the western side of the planet. We have an umbrella civilization, and that's Western secular humanism. It is mostly governmental and instrumentalist, by which I mean it isn't in and of itself a system of values. It is an instrumentality by means of which systems of values are governed and tested. Western secular humanism doesn't in and of itself dictate to you how to live your life. What it says to you is, I want you to live whatever life you live in reasonable harmony with all other systems of life. And here is a way of testing what it is you say life is all about. To a very great extent, we're living today inside the world conjured up by Montesquieu and some of the French philosophes of the 1700s, a bit earlier and a bit later. The civilization is such that it permits an enormous spectrum of subcultures to exist within the umbrella. As I say, it's Western, secular humanism. It's Western because it pertains only to this side of the planet. It's secular because it makes no appeal to the supernatural. And it's humanist because of its emphasis upon man, upon the sciences, upon the person, upon the individual, not as a member of a tribe or a group, but as a self qua self, someone hungry to develop herself or himself to the fullest of her or his abilities, you know, the one time around we have on this planet. Enormous problems result from this. At the same time, enormous creativity. It is a civilization, with all of its problems, still at a seminal phase of creativity. No one would be hard put to name 10 major works on the western side of this planet in the last 15 or 20 years. Works that have opened radical new windows into the way we structure the world, the way we think the world. Seminal works. That's one of the ways of testing a civilization. The tiny elements inside this umbrella, the subcultures, as it were, inside this umbrella, keep bumping up against one another and keep bumping up against the umbrella. And my own feeling is that one of the great things that the novel has done is record these bump-ups. Jane Austen recording her little bump-ups, and Dickens recording his little bump-ups, and Hemingway recording his bump-ups, and Faulkner, the South, and Updike, the Protestants, and Cheever, the Protestants, and Bellow were secular Jews, and Potok, irreligious Jews, and so on and so forth. All kinds of bump-ups occur. You can be peripherally attached to your subculture and peripherally attached to the umbrella civilization. That's one kind of confrontation, and so on and so forth. I happen to be very profoundly attached to my subculture, Jewish. I come from its very heart, from its core. And at the same time, I'm part of the heart and the core of the umbrella civilization. So my particular confrontation is what I call core-to-core culture confrontation. That's what I'm trying to write about in my books. Danny Saunders confronts Freud. Reuven Walter confronts a new way of evaluating the sacred texts of the ancient world. David Lurie confronts modern Bible scholarship. Bashalev confronts art. All of these from the heart of the umbrella civilization. This book, Wanderings, is about all the different kinds of culture confrontations that the Jewish people has experienced since its beginning. And all the kinds, core to core, periphery to periphery, and so on and so forth. With Canaanite civilization, we experienced confrontations straight across the board, periphery to periphery, periphery to core, and so on. With the Romans, we experienced only periphery to periphery. The Romans never understood us. We never understood the Romans, as a result of which we were constantly at war with them, and they destroyed us. They destroyed the temple and, for all intents and purposes, wiped out the Palestinian Jewish community. With Islam, we had a magnificent core-to-core culture confrontation in southern Spain, and gold resulted from that. This is the kind of ongoing dynamic that Jews have experienced, and interestingly enough, we on the western side of this planet are experiencing it today. That's why I think it's very important that each of us knows which of the subgroups he or she belongs to, so that the confrontation is as close as possible core to core, because that is the richest kind of confrontation. Those moments in the history of our species when cores of culture have clashed have been those moments when gold has resulted. It's almost natural that if the hearts of two cultures are going to clash.
I can think of a clash that's happening now, although it's kind of within the same culture. You've talked about how Judaism has changed through its contact with other peoples and other cultures, and how that change has offered many rich things to the religion, yet usually in a religion people are very conservative about change when it's happening in your time. Right now in Judaism and in Christianity and probably in a lot of other religions as well, people are trying to figure out what role women should play in the religion. Should women be rabbis? Should women be ministers? Should women be cantors? In Judaism, the role of the woman and the woman in the home and in the family be reevaluated? And of course, everybody has their own answers to that, and each form of Judaism has its own answers. What kind of confrontations do you see that as being now?
I think that's another example of a general reevaluation on the part of the species on the western side of the planet of the role of a member of the species whose life we all perceive to be, whose talents we all perceive to be simply being wasted. The role of the woman was in the home at a point in time when the man had to go out and be the hunter and the gatherer and the killer of the game and so on and so forth. Someone had to be back there to cook the stuff and take care of the kids and so on. That sort of role doesn't exist anymore, which means that the woman now sits and does nothing or plays cards or wastes her life. Generally, when you have a situation of this kind, it is felt to be by the species non-life enhancing. The species can sustain a feeling like this over a protracted period of time, but not for too long. Probably behind this women's liberation movement is the instinctive notion on the part of the species on the western side of the planet that a whole segment of the species is simply being wasted, creatively wasted, that is to say. And that is something as a biological entity that we cannot sustain. We can't sustain it psychologically. Our system simply can't sustain the notion that a whole segment of our self as a total species is simply being wasted. That is probably the instinctive underpinning to what we explicitly refer to as the women's liberation movement. So I think that this is not anything that somebody dreamed up. This is just something that the species gropes for blindly in order to continue to express itself in a life-enhancing way. Biological organisms express themselves in life-enhancing ways for themselves. I don't know of any highly developed form of life that willingly seeks its own destruction. And since we are the highest form of life, it's clear that we don't willingly seek our own destruction. If we sense that we're off in a path that is destructive, we're going to turn around and try to backtrack or carve new paths for ourselves. And it's clear enough to me that at this point in time, the notion of half of the species wasting its creativity is regarded by a significant number of members of the species as non-life enhancing. Hence the drive for a creative position for women, you see, on the part of the total species, at least on the western side of the planet. It isn't the case, by the way, that all religionists are conservative or reactionary. I don't know that that's the case at all. I think that religionists span the whole spectrum of human expression, very much the way politicians do, or politics does, or very much the way any discipline does. You will, for example, find in physics very reactionary physicists who hold with their fingernails to all theories of physics and are terrified of new
theories.
I think
what I meant to say is that the institutions tend to be conservative.
All institutions, by their very nature, are conservative. That's what an institution is really all about. The most dynamic institution of Western civilization is supposed to be the university. As a matter of fact, the university is the generating plant of Western secular humanism, just as the church is for Christianity and the synagogue is for Judaism. And we know that there are universities that tend to be very slow-moving in the way they change and adapt to new ideas.
So you think that Judaism should or eventually will accept women into positions of religious leadership?
Of course.
Okay. Do you see Judaism as being a culture, a religion, or both?
Well, it's clearly far more than a religion. because there are Jews who are not religious. And you would really have to be very rigid in your interpretation of Judaism to read non-religious or secular Jews out of Judaism. For example, the secular Jew who eats on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, in Israel, on a left-wing kibbutz, and sends his sons off to fight in the Israeli army, or is a general in the Israeli army and loses sons, or dies himself. You wouldn't want to read somebody like that out of the Jewish people because he doesn't observe the commandments. No, it's clearly far more than what we would technically call a religion, that is to say, a theocratically oriented system of thought, certainly at this point in time. It's a group of, it is a culture, it is a civilization, it's an entity, an aggregate of human beings who've committed themselves to a certain position, a certain way of thinking, a certain history, whether the commitment is articulate or inarticulate. Most of the time it's inarticulate. Civilizations don't function articulately. That is to say, nobody says, I am a member of, unless there's a crisis situation. Most of the time you just live it. No, you're dealing, I think, with a lifestyle and a way of thinking the world, and a way of thinking the world that permits you a whole spectrum of thought, from the rigidly religious way of thinking to all the way on the other side to the rigidly and fanatically secular way of thinking. You can find this almost a secular a fanatic, as fanatic a secularist as you can find a fanatic a religionist sometimes. So this whole spectrum of thought is found in Judaism. And you're really dealing essentially with an alternate form of structuring human experience, of seeing the world. The people who are familiar with Jewish civilization and Jewish history understand some of the components that are right at the core of things Jewish. The redemptive concept of history, the notion that, okay, there are components of history that seem to be meaningless. Well, pump meaning into them. Brighten them. Put all your energy into that rather than into messing the world up more. The moral dimension. This is not to say that all Jews are goody-goodies. This is simply to say that here is a system of thought that makes a concerted effort to take the world and structure it in such a way that it is life-enhancing, meaningful. Take this awesomeness we call the universe and pump meaning into it and say that at least this much meaning is what it contains. These are some of the base elements of the Jewish way of thinking reality, and of course this gets spelled out in observances and in rituals and in all the things that our species generally does when it makes commitments about reality and then wants to spell it out in day-to-day life.
You've lived for a few years in Israel. Do you find the way Judaism is practiced in Israel to be much different than the way it's practiced in America, or the notion of being Jewish to be much different in Israel than in America?
Well, because the civilization there or the culture there is Hebraic, you're talking there a shorthand that is very difficult to talk here. That is to say, there is much to be said about the notion of language as a fundamental component of a civilization. Still, since the Jew has lived in exilic communities for 2,000 years, he's developed a kind of exilic shorthand at the same time. What's happening in Israel, of course, is that whatever it is that the Jew will be for the next 1,000 years of his and her history is inconceivable without Israel as the leaven for it. It will be some sort of fusion of exilic and Israeli cultures. Nothing is conceivable creatively or seminally in Jewish life without the centrality of Israel.
Why do you believe
because,
that?
Because the whole creative essence of Judaism, we've had two civilizations so far as a people, and both of them were formed on the land. Now, the creative essence of the people is so intricately locked up with the geography and the history of that land that it's almost impossible to dissociate it. Not almost, I would say that it is impossible. The land is organic to the way the people structures the world. You can't think Judaism without thinking Isaiah wandering around the land. You can't think Judaism without thinking Jeremiah. At the same time, you can't think Judaism without thinking Ezekiel and the exile. That's true. The two components are linked.
Yet, for most Jews living in this country, their heritage goes back to Eastern European countries, for many Jews anyways. And, you know, I think a lot of people would be hard-pressed to, if no matter how long they spent in any library, to really trace their family heritage towards Israel. Yet many Jewish people consider Israel to be the homeland. You know, is it fair to think of Israel as the homeland when in fact, more immediately, your heritage isn't from that area at all?
I'm not altogether certain that I was referring to it as homeland, which is another concept. I'm talking about it mostly as the core of the creative essence of the two past civilizations of the Jewish people. We've had two periods of seminal creativity in the past. One, the biblical, utterly inconceivable without that piece of territory, which is where it took place. And two, the rabbinic. Two great pieces of literature were created on that piece of territory. One, the Bible, and the other, the Mishnah. Those two bodies of literature are inconceivable away from that piece of land. Those are the seminal periods of creativity of the Jewish people. I'm hard-pressed at this point to conceive of the possibility of there being a third seminal period of creativity without in some way having the land participate in it as a significant component. I simply cannot imagine that sort of creativity taking place seminally. See, everything that's happened in Jewish life for the past 2,000 years has happened as a spin-off from the period when the Mishnah was created, which is that body of Jewish law and lore from which the Gemara was created, which we call Talmudic or Rabbinic Judaism. Now, whatever it is that Judaism might be for the next 1,000 years, and I don't know what it will be, or if it will indeed be anything, but whatever, if it is anything creatively, it seems to me that it is very difficult to conceive of it being anything creative without having that piece of land somehow plugged into it in a very significant way.
Do you have strong feelings about the political situation in Israel?
I think that the peace with Egypt is something that nobody could have foreseen 5 years ago. And it indicates to us the possibilities for peace. I think that Arab nationalism will spend itself, ultimately, as all nationalisms do, and that in the final analysis, some modus vivendi will be affected in that part of the world. It may take 10 years, it may take 20 years, but it will happen. And the peace that will settle on that part of the world will enable the energies that are presently going into concern for self-preservation to be focused upon creativity. I think it will happen.
You were talking before about cultural confrontations. What happens when two people who are part of cultures or two cultures that have come up with different solutions to the major questions facing us meet? Do you think that that is happening now in Israel between Israelis and Arabs, between Jews and Arabs living in Israel?
I wish it were. What we're seeing there is a confrontation of peripheries of culture, complicated by the most peripheral elements of culture, and that is nationalisms. There's nothing more peripheral than two armies meeting in the field. And nationalism is simply a kind of civilian translation of armies meeting in the field. Armies meeting in the field in this day and age is simply the actual concretization of the civilian translated as soldier. or in nationalist confrontation. I think this is just going to spin itself out. I really wish it were a culture confrontation of the sort that occurred in the past. The culture confrontation, for example, that occurred between Jews and Muslims in southern Spain, in Cordova, about the year 800, 900, 1000, where two cultures fused, and the result was an explosion of creativity that we marvel at to this day. Poetry, philosophy, theology, study of language, study of sacred texts, pharmacology, navigation, science, the most incredible explosion of creativity on the part of Arabs, Muslims, and Jews as a result of this heart-to-heart confrontation of cultures in this magnificent southern Spanish city called Cordova. And that's the kind of culture confrontation that would be a dream today. That doesn't exist. It doesn't exist for a variety of reasons. One, both cultures at that part of the world are no longer in their phases of seminal creativity. Neither Rabbinic Judaism nor Islam. Whereas at the time that they met in Spain, both were in the phase of seminal creativity. Rabbinic Judaism is simply spent. It, for all intents and purposes, was destroyed by Hitler. And it is no longer in a phase of radical, new, seminal, original creativity. The same thing is true of Islam. So what you have is nationalisms meeting. That is to say, periphery-to-periphery culture confrontation. That sort of culture confrontation always creates monstrosities. And that's the sort of thing that we see all too much of in the Middle East today.
Chaim Potok, we are just about out of time. I take it you're engaged now in writing a new novel.
That's right.
Do you have any sense of when we can expect it to be completed?
No. Okay. Uh-huh. I hope it'll be completed when its own demands are met.
Right. Well, good luck with the novel.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with novelist Chaim Potok, but his most recent book is a work of nonfiction. It's a work of history called Wanderings, Chaim Potok's History of the Jews, and it's just been published in paper by Fawcett Books. Chaim Potok, by the way, lives in the Philadelphia area, and he's also lived for a few years during the earlier part of the 1970s in Israel. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by the two people who are now performing in the Annenberg Center in what is being called An Evening Without Liza Minnelli. Also with us will be the person who wrote that evening of song and sketches. At 3 o'clock, or about 2:45, I should say, we'll be joined by Cheetah Rivera, who's now performing at the Burgundy Room in the Fairmont Hotel. Francis Davis will be with us at 3:30 to review new jazz releases. And later in the afternoon, about 4:30, we'll be hearing from a University of Pennsylvania-based linguist who's been studying the development of mainline dialect. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can join us then. The technical director for this afternoon's show was Scott Williams. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. Contributing today was Charles Hardy. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a real good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.